It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Some argue a dominant issue both now and in the coming generation is the privacy of your data. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. Google CEO Sundar Pichai is scheduled today to testify before a House panel on issues stemming from transparency with its consumers or lack of transparency. But as Marketplace's Erica Barras tells us, the questioning could go beyond that.
Google has received a warm reception on Capitol Hill before, but concerns about privacy, data practices, and bias mean things are different now, says Steve Weber, a professor at the School of Information at UC Berkeley.
I think they're walking into what will be a moderately hostile environment.
That's because Democrats and Republicans have said they plan on asking some tough questions of the tech giant. There have been concerns about how the company prioritizes what comes up in searches.
And in particular, what does it do when the company has a product or service that competes with another company?
That's Mark Rottenberg with the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Google's also likely to face some of the same scrutiny Facebook did earlier this year about what it does with our data. Tiffany Lee researches technology law and policy at Yale Law School.
How much data does Google collect on each person? How much data is actually used in advertising?
Those questions come as some major technology companies, including Apple, Amazon, and Google, have expressed support for the idea of a national consumer privacy law. I'm Erica Barras from Marketplace.
Not a simple question now, but what water is surface water? Today, the Environmental Protection Agency is set to release a plan that will replace an Obama-era definition of this. This is about what waterways are federally protected. Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports.
Rivers, lakes, and streams are pretty obviously surface water, and therefore protected by the 1972 Clean Water Act. But what about smaller tributaries or a wetland that feeds into a river? Also, yes. But now, what about marshes or streams that dry into land in the summer? The Obama EPA declared yes in 2015, and Blan Holman at the Southern Environmental Law Center says that makes sense.
In order to protect a drinking water source, you need to make sure that the waters that are flowing into it, the tributaries, are pure.
But industry groups dispute whether the Clean Water Act intended to include these part-time waterways. Don Parrish with the American Farm Bureau Federation called that
an extremely broad and overreaching definition.
He says farmers had to determine if standing water in a field was actually a federally protected wetland. Early reports indicate the new definition of surface water would classify only full-time waterways for federal protection. It'll first have to go through a public comment process and then likely lawsuits. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
We keep an eye on markets. At one point, the Dow was down 507 points yesterday, but it finished up 34 points, a tenth of a percent. Some point to prospects for U.S.-China trade talks resuming, which they did with a phone call last night. London, the FTSE, is up 1.2%, with the British currency recovering some from a Brexit tantrum. The Dow future this morning is up 0.7%, the S&P future up 0.6%. Marketplace is more than a radio program. As a nonprofit news organization, we strive to provide a public service that fulfills a vital mission. Now is the time to show that you value what you learn from Marketplace. Invest in the news you trust, and your donation will go twice as far, thanks to our friends at Candida. Give today at marketplace.org and keep reliable, independent journalism going strong. Thank you. In a divided country, the occasional shared experience that unites us all is welcome. Well, here's one this morning. If not at this very moment, then at some point today, all of us will have skin contact with some form of fabric, like harnessing fire. Harnessing the fiber is one of the great human inventions. There's a new book about this called The Golden Thread. The author, Cassia St. Clair, is connecting here from London. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So there's naked, then there's the fig leaf period of human history, presumably, then animal pelts. But it's your argument here in the book that it's fabric, woven cloth, that really changes everything?
Obviously, I'm completely and hopelessly biased because I wrote a book all about fabric, but I think that fabric is tremendously important and finds its way into all sorts of areas of life that we don't expect.
For Vikings, fabric is like rocket fuel. It's the sailcloth that pushes their ships so that trade can happen.
Yes, when you think of wool, or at least when I think of wool, you think of woolly jumpers. And that is just not a material you would ever imagine would make good sailcloth. However, archaeologists were lucky enough to find a tiny piece of fabric that had been sort of stuffed into a roof in northern Norway. And this piece of cloth turned out to be a piece of sailcloth that had been made out of wool. And looking at this piece of cloth very closely, they were able to see that actually the Vikings had been able to make incredibly efficient sailcloth. And this sailcloth was part of the technology that allowed them to get so far into trade really across the world.
What do archaeologists tell us? Where were humans weaving first? Do we have any sense?
So the very first fibers that we know about are around 32,500 years old and were found completely by chance in a cave in Georgia in the Caucasus.
Now, you know, I was looking at the book, it really stood out. We think of the Industrial Revolution, I don't know, as factory mass production pushed by steam that's the driving force. But in a sense, you're arguing in the book that maybe it's not the steam, but it's the cotton that's the crucial ingredient in the Industrial Revolution.
It's been known for quite a long time that cotton was really a key ingredient in the Industrial Revolution. Cloth that was produced in India could then be exported or imported. Cotton kind of really greased the wheels of international trade.
Cassia St. Clair has just written the book, The Golden Thread, How Fabric Changed History. Ms. St. Clair, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Cotton's early production efficiencies depended on the horrors of slavery, of course. That book has a chapter devoted to this. Our producers are Victoria Craig, Michael Lipkin, Janaki Mehta, Daniel Shin, and Sasha Woodruff. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.